This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast. From Paris to penury, can the most cosmopolitan city in the Middle East rise again?
You can imagine the whiplash that people have gone through in the last 2 years. One day you're living in a country that feels like it's Greece or southern Italy, and one day you're living in Venezuela.
Yes, that's ahead on the show. And an Australian charity has developed new technology to fight modern slavery. Joe Biden may be facing political setbacks at home, but it seems he's having more luck at the Vatican. The US president has been under pressure from a group of conservative Catholic bishops not to take communion because he supports abortion. But Mr. Biden said that at a meeting with the Pope this week, Francis called him, quote, a good Catholic who should continue to take communion. The Vatican has not commented on that meeting. Now, it's a thread stretching across an entire continent from Beirut to Kabul and on to Hong Kong. For two decades, their people have built vibrant, increasingly liberal societies, but they've lived under threat from very powerful forces. Now Lebanon is fracturing, the Taliban is tightening its repression in Afghanistan, and China continues to crack down on Hong Kong. In an urgent new essay for The Atlantic, Lebanese-American writer Kim Huttas says this is now what the loss of freedom looks like. I caught up with Kim at her home in Beirut, which was once considered the Paris of the Middle East.
The rapid inflation, the rising living costs, the lifting of subsidies on medication, and most importantly on petrol, added to the pandemic, added to the Beirut port blast last year, has all meant that the city sort of feels like it's emptied of its inhabitants. Across the country, people are taking leave of absence because they don't have the money needed to fill up their cars to drive to work. It feels like this country is imploding further and further. This all started in 2019 with protests against the establishment, the ruling political class, that is part cartel, part former warlords, and part propped up by Hezbollah, the Shia militant group that's loyal to Iran. But the protests only accelerated the inevitable, which was the economic collapse. This country's economy was built on a Ponzi scheme, in essence. And so 2 years later, this trifecta of crises, the economic crises, the pandemic, and the Beirut port blast, has left Lebanon and Beirut feeling quite forlorn and desolate. And so the tension is no longer on the streets because it feels quite empty, but it's within people's hearts and within people's homes and at the airport, where so many Lebanese are leaving and saying goodbye to their loved ones.
Kim, have I read a figure somewhere that something like 70 to 80% of Lebanese now live on or below the poverty line?
That is correct. The World Bank has given this estimate of 75%. That is in a country where, until recently, the number was about 25%. And so you can imagine the whiplash that people have gone through in the last 2 years, where their living standards dropped so precipitously that one day you're living in a country that feels like it's Greece or southern Italy, and one day you're living in Venezuela without the oil riches, which don't get to the people in Venezuela either anyway. Yeah. So it's this whiplash that is really hard to deal with for people. And the World Bank has described the economic crisis as one of the worst economic crises in the last 150 years in the world. You offset that with a lot of remittances that still come into the country from the very, very large diaspora, including in Australia and in Canada, in the US, and in Latin America. And it helps a lot of people keep going. Because today, as remittances go, if in the past to maintain your family's living standards in Lebanon, you had to send $1,000 to make it worth it, to make a difference. Today, even $100 or $200 in real cash will help people get through the month. And so I think remittances are playing a huge part keeping this country going as best as it can.
Yeah, Lebanon came through a decade or more of civil war during the 1980s. Would I be right in saying that today it is the most fragile it's been in four decades?
Probably yes, although I shudder to think that we might be becoming even more fragile. I mean, I don't know what else is in store. We keep thinking that we've hit rock bottom, but there seems to be no bottom. What's difficult and what I detail in my piece is what I describe as the whiplash and the progress that's yanked away from you. It's the fact that we have lived through 15 years of civil war, and then we spent three decades rebuilding. Children who grew up in the civil war became parents and they had children and were hoping to provide a good life for their children and their children's future. And they built their businesses and they put their faith in the country again. And now they're seeing it all collapse and they're having to make really difficult choices about whether to stay and stick it out just a little bit longer in case it gets better, or to call it quits and leave. And it's a story that is very specific to Lebanon, but it's also unfolding elsewhere. I talk about Hong Kong in my story. I talk about Afghanistan. All three places, very different, and yet going through the same very precipitous change, which in Lebanon and in Afghanistan comes not only with the ripping away of freedoms, but also comes with an economic collapse for sure, and unrest and violence. And in Hong Kong, the economic collapse isn't what is sinking the city. It's this authoritarianism that is strangling it by China. But yeah. I do also worry about Hong Kong's economy, frankly.
I'm fascinated to know why, in your view, the religious settlement, that was the dividing up of power between Shia and Sunni and Maronite Christians and Orthodox Christians and Druze, why it finally reached its use-by date in Lebanon?
I think we can be too focused on the fact that this is a religious divide, and we lose sight of the fact that religion is often a convenient tool to divide. And it's used by the politicians in power. The way that the power is carved up in the country has been this way since the establishment of the Lebanese Republic in the 40s. It's not any different. It is a unspoken agreement that the power will be divided between the different religious sects. But what it allows people to do then, who rise to the top to rule, is to maintain their grip on their community by amplifying differences and by painting the other as an existential threat. And a group like Hezbollah is very good at that. They are almost the sole representative of the Shia community because they have painted themselves as the only possible defenders of the Shia community. Now, the Shia community in Lebanon was traditionally downtrodden, poorer than others, and the rise of a group like Hezbollah has given them a sense of power, of protection, and entitlement. And today, they're stuck in many ways. I do not believe that a majority of Shias support the group, but they are stuck because the group affords protection, convinces them that without them, the Shias would be sent packing or sent to become, you know, shoeshine boys again. And Hezbollah does that with the coercion, with arms, with assassinations. It's very difficult to undo that grip. And in other communities, it's not as pronounced, but it exists as well.
Yeah. We're speaking with Kim Huttas of The Atlantic. You also heard Kim recently talk about her new book, Black Wave, or her recent book, Black Wave. We're discussing her piece in The Atlantic, What the Loss of Freedom Feels Like. That is a fascinating comparison that you've drawn, for example, with Hong Kong. which is now succumbing day by day to the dictates of the Communist Party of China. Give us a picture of Hong Kong and Beirut when they were at their peak of liberalism and prosperity and cosmopolitanism, because there was a very strong likeness.
There was a strong likeness, and more so than people can even imagine, those who aren't familiar with the details of Lebanese history. Of course, just to sort of make clear that Lebanon and Hong Kong's histories are very different. I mean, Lebanon was not under, was never a British colony. It used to be under French mandate, but more recently, it was an independent country, whereas Hong Kong was handed over from the British in 1996. And the years that followed that were, in parallel with Lebanon, years of continued, as Lebanon was rebuilding itself after the Civil War, there was creativity and design and fashion and restaurants. It was an exuberant place, and so was Hong Kong, as it had always been. And despite the fact that it was no longer under British rule, it continued in that tradition with some trepidation.
Got pretty pricey. People. I've got to say, Beirut got pretty pricey for the visitor.
It got pretty pricey, but very, very intoxicating. There's so much energy here, similarly as Hong Kong. You know, these places sit at the crossroads of civilizations, of geography, of history. But Lebanon, during the 90s and up until 2005, was under Syrian occupation. In a nutshell, after the war ended with a Syrian occupation, which was one way to silence the guns. And Syria is, of course, a Soviet-style, repressive, oppressive country. And it occupied Lebanon, this freewheeling, capitalist, everything goes type of country. And so the parallels were drawn between Lebanon and Hong Kong. Look, it can work. You do your thing as Lebanon, as Hong Kong. We'll do our thing as Syria and China. One country, two systems. Except eventually, it doesn't work anymore. And today, Lebanon and Hong Kong are victims of a system that became too greedy, too oppressive, and wanted more and eventually strangled Lebanon and Hong Kong.
Yes, so as Beijing is to Hong Kong, Damascus is to Lebanon, strangling the very life out of it. But there must be this one significant difference, in the sense that Beijing holds almost complete control over China and over Hong Kong. It seems to me that Damascus has a very fragile hold on its own power, let alone in Lebanon. I mean, is there a threat of Lebanon fracturing rather than anything else?
No, I would like to think that there's a threat or a hope of Lebanon re-emerging, in fact, because things are dynamic in the Middle East. I know we like to think that this is a region that will never sort itself out, that it's hopeless, and it has been for a long time, but things are dynamic. Things are still changing. The die is not cast for the next century. You're absolutely right to point out that Syria's hold on Lebanon isn't the same today as it used to be, and isn't the same as China's hold over Hong Kong. If only because in 2005, Syrian troops were forced to withdraw from Lebanon, but they left behind an entrenched system that continues to serve them and their allies. Those are Hezbollah and Iran, which also holds sway in this country. But the difference today is that, as I said, this is a dynamic region where, yes, Bashar al-Assad is still in power in Damascus, but it's all a bit tenuous. He has to rely on Russia and Iran. Iran feels like it's on the ascent, but it's also facing a lot of pushback in Lebanon and Iraq. There are dynamics between, other countries in the region and Israel, the Abraham Accords, which were signed. And you don't see that kind of dynamism or those kinds of dynamics in Asia with China and Hong Kong. What you see is a hegemon taking over. And there's a sense of finality for Hong Kong. And who knows what might happen now with Taiwan, that I find is more worrisome and frankly more depressing than what we're going through in Lebanon. I know that's hard to believe, but that was my conclusion. This piece that I wrote struck a chord with so many people. I got so many emails and tweets and private messages from people from Afghanistan, from Hong Kong, but also from China. if you want to believe that.
I do.
Really taken aback by this young man who knows Lebanon very well and knows Hong Kong very well, but is Chinese, and said he had looked at the protests in Hong Kong and was so hopeful because growing up, his hope in China was that his country's future would be Hong Kong. And now his hopes have been dashed and he doesn't see that in his lifetime it can be reversed. And I find that incredibly sad. And this is the kind of global story that I think my article gets to, is that we're losing something that we thought was inevitable in the 90s, which was the progress of democracy and liberal values.
Yeah, the outlier here, though, is surely Kabul, Afghanistan, because you make this very persuasive argument that Afghanistan, Lebanon, Hong Kong all experienced 20 years or so of great hope and expectation. But it seems to me that in Afghanistan, you've really got now a complete totalitarian power. Whereas in Lebanon, it's hard to think of who controls Lebanon.
Yes, we are an unruly bunch.
But maybe for the better.
Maybe for the better. It's true. I mean, you cannot have one dictator here. Although you will have those who argue that Iran and Hezbollah are pretty much in control of this country. I would like to posit that they are not, and that the pushback continues, and that Iran and Hezbollah are a little bit on the back foot at the moment in the region, in Lebanon, in Iraq. It's not going well for them. Does that mean that it unravels for them? I'm not sure, but they're never fully in control. And I think that the story of Afghanistan still needs to be written. I don't think it's that easy for the Taliban to rule a country like Afghanistan 20 years later. They don't necessarily have the capacity. They don't necessarily have the people. I think they too are going to find that the Afghanistan they're trying to control today is not the Afghanistan of the 90s. It's Afghanistan 2.0. And yes, a lot of people have left, but a lot of people stayed. And they're not willing to go back to the past. They want to move forward. And so the Taliban are almost anachronistic in that sense. And, you know, I always remain hopeful. And so I would like to hope that they're going to face some trouble and that it's not going to be that easy, and that the Afghanistan that was emerging over the past two decades will be able to push back to some extent.
Very insightful to speak with you, Kim Hattas. She's contributing writer at The Atlantic, a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Kim's most recent book is Black Wave. Thank you for coming back to the program, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Along the west coast of Africa are remnants of a tragic history. Crumbling ports remind us of the Atlantic slave trade that began 400 years ago. But exploitation continues to blight the region to this day. The Global Slavery Index and the International Labour Organization estimate 9.2 million Africans are trapped in slavery or forced labour. The Global Freedom Network has been working with local religious leaders on new anti-slavery technology. An app will make it easier to report cases and to link faith leaders with local human rights groups. Franca Pellegrini is director of the Global Freedom Network.
The Faith for Freedom app is the first smartphone app designed especially for faith leaders to fight modern slavery and human trafficking. So that was developed after a trip last year in January in Ghana when I met with faith leaders, and some of them knew a bit about modern slavery and then some didn't know much at all. So really it was kind of going back a step, and an idea was formed to start an app whereby they could learn about the problem, how to detect it, and then to find, you know, if they need expert help, where they find referral pathways. So in that app is NGOs, social workers, and law enforcement agencies, as well as other resources such as prayers and a video with a sheikh and a Catholic priest talking about how to talk to your congregations and what they can do about it.
but as a piece of technology designed to assist with detection. So what happens here if a community leader, especially a faith leader, suspects mm-hmm. a case of modern slavery or forced labour? What does he or she do with that app?
Well, in that app, there is some case studies talking about the different forms of modern slavery, child labour, debt bondage. And so they can get an idea of what modern slavery looks like in Ghana. And then from there, that video which I mentioned, the two faith leaders talk about how to talk about this issue in your place of worship. And then also, when you get to a point where you feel like you don't have the expertise, then you can get on the map there, find a referral pathway. They can click on those and speak to someone about getting that expert help to actually identify firstly if it is modern slavery, and if it is, then what are the next steps to approach it.
So this app could in fact connect faith leaders who are on the lookout for what they believe could be modern slavery to police or to human rights organisations?
Correct. We've got law enforcement in all of those regions. So Ghana has a human trafficking unit and we have numbers in there that they can call and talk to get some support. But also there's religious NGOs and then more community-based NGOs. Some of those include social workers as well with that expertise of helping that faith leader, like I say, firstly identify if it is a case and if it is, you know, what are the next steps?
You recently returned from Ghana, where 14 religious leaders signed this joint declaration against modern slavery. Why are faith leaders so critical to the fight against modern slavery?
Faith leaders have a unique position. They see into the hearts of their communities, and I guess they see things that others don't see. So then intrinsic to the lives of so many African communities and congregations. Obviously, Africa for us is a really important place for Global Freedom Network to work in because it's a continent of deep faith and high prevalence of the issue. So faith leaders really, you know, understand their communities. They've got that trust. A lot of people go to them with their issues. They're crucial in this, you know, the fight against modern slavery.
Was it hard to get faith leaders of different perspectives around a table cooperating on this?
Africa, actually, as much as it's such a complex continent, it actually wasn't. So I went last year on a scoping trip and met with a lot of the faith leaders and they were on board straight away, whereas I haven't had, I guess, this level of uptake instantly in other places in the world. So no, not at all, actually. It was such a joy to have people that were really embracing and really wanted to help.
So no problem with interfaith cooperation. In fact, it seems that's the strength behind it.
Absolutely. Yeah, the interfaith in Ghana is incredible. For example, the video which I spoke about, which is in the app, we filmed that in the Catholic Cathedral in Accra, and Sheikh Chabu, we said to him, we're going to film it. He was like, oh, absolutely, no worries. So that's definitely the interfaith community there is incredible.
Frank, why is Africa and West Africa, it seems, still a hotspot for human trafficking, for modern slavery? And I say that knowing the awful history of people stolen from West Africa. All up and down the coast of West Africa, there are old slave ports. Why does it still continue to be such a troublesome area?
I think it's got a few regions. So, for example, it's got our sectors, so cocoa, Lake Volta with fishing, the timber industry. Unfortunately, those industries do have modern slavery. I mean, cocoa's a really shocking sector in terms of what's happening in that space. There is lots of good being done. While I was there, I spoke to a couple of NGOs that work in that space, and a lot is changing, but it is slowly changing. So more needs to be done more in that region. And look, fishing in Lake Volta, obviously with children there, helping their parents. And it's obviously very sad. But again, we've got a wonderful partner, Challenging Heights, who work on Lake Volta with children. And we work with Challenging Heights as well and have done for the past 7 years. So there is change. But yeah, again, it needs to happen quicker.
So in Africa, I get the impression the issue is less direct human trafficking to other countries and more the exploitation, the forced labour within those industries that are locally based.
Yes, inside those countries, yes, they have their own exploitation, but also cross-border is a huge problem. And that's one we're actually working. We've got two working groups in Ghana. One is doing a campaign around International Migrants Day in December, and the other one is doing a cross-border campaign because, for example, in Ghana, a lot of Ghanaians will be promised a job in another country in Africa or might be even in the Middle East or it might be in Italy or Europe. So really trying to get them to understand if they are moving from Ghana to another country, what are the risks, what are the questions there to ask their recruiter before they make that move.
Outside of Africa, how difficult has it been, however, to get faith leaders together? I think you suggested there were some challenges outside of Africa.
Yeah, there has been. I think it's about, for example, with Africa, they were all just working together and they're all willing to, for example, the working groups, we had two put up their hands to lead those and chair those groups. In other parts, it's getting them to understand how important this issue is in their country, but you need someone to lead that. And I guess with faith leaders, the issue is they're throwing so many things at them, you know, whether it's modern slavery, climate change, poverty. So it's really kind of fighting against other issues and getting them to prioritise that. But I think that what's happening, well, what I've seen in the time I've been working at Global Freedom Network is a lot of the younger generations of faith leaders are really switched on. They're hearing more about it or they've heard about it the last few years. So they really want to take it on board. And as well, it intersects with climate change, it intersects with poverty. So, you know, they understand that maybe with starting with this human rights issue that it can obviously help some of these other issues as well.
Yeah, you mentioned climate change there, Franca. Of course, that's in the news all this week and next, quite probably. How does human trafficking interact with climate change?
So, for example, I guess with natural disasters, so, you know, if there's a flood, then people need to move from their village or they perhaps even have to move to another country. So then that kind of intersects then with migration. And I guess migration does open them up to exploitation in terms of taking whatever work they can find. And then it's perhaps more members of the family having to work, younger members of the family to support their family, kids leaving schools, not having the education. So again, it's all interconnected into modern slavery.
That's Franca Pellegrini of the Global Freedom Network, which is part of the Australia-based Walk Free Foundation. Now, to bring this story home a bit, for 3 years we have been charting the excruciating pace of a modern slavery bill in New South Wales. Now, this bill, when it was passed in 2018, was considered of gold standard. The bill has now been redrawn and, according to reports in the Catholic Weekly, it is significantly weakened. It raises the threshold by which companies have to report from an annual turnover of $50 million to $100 million, and it brings it into line with Commonwealth laws, but the Commonwealth laws do not impose financial penalties if companies don't comply. Now, the Sydney Archbishop, Anthony Fisher, has spoken out against these changes and urged New South Wales MPs to stick to their original, very tough gold standard anti-slavery laws. Now, that is the program for this week. You can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Hong Jiang and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.